This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies, senior writer for the Philadelphia Daily News, filling in for Terry Gross. Our guest Darren Aronofsky directed the film The Wrestler. Its leading actors Mickey Rourke and Marissa Tomei earned Oscar nominations, and Rourke won a Golden Globe for his performance. Rourke plays Randy the Ram Robinson, a wrestler who was a star in the 80s and is now living in a trailer park, wrestling for small change with newcomers and has-beens in high school auditoriums and American Legion halls. He's physically and emotionally broken, but refuses to give up wrestling because it's the only thing he does well and the only place he feels appreciated. The person he's closest to is a stripper, played by Marissa Tomei, who's also getting too old for the job. The wrestling matches may be fixed, but the Ram is still subjecting his failing body to enormous punishment in the ring. Aronofsky's scenes reveal how the fights are pre-planned, but also show how much real pain the wrestlers inflict on each other. Terry spoke to Darren Aronofsky in January. Here's a scene just before one of the small-time wrestling matches. The promoter is backstage telling the wrestlers what the lineup is.
All right, SLG, where are you? You're up first against TDS.
Thank you.
Second, we got Havoc and Cobian versus Billy the Kid and Lex Lethal.
I got you tonight.
Third, Sabian versus Devin Moore. Fourth, Judas the Traitor versus Rob Echoes, Intermission. Fifth, Kevin Matthews versus Inferno. Sixth, we got Suga and DJ Hyde versus the Funky Samoans. Seventh, Paul Enormous and Andy Anderson versus Jim Powers and Papa Don. And last but not least, for the strap, we got Tommy Rotten versus Randy the Ram. All right, you guys got it?
Yep.
All right, let's do this.
Darren Aronofsky, welcome to Fresh Air. I would have assumed that if someone made a movie about wrestling, that it would be a kind of satirical, campy film, since a lot of wrestling, particularly wrestling in the 80s, was so campy. But your film isn't campy at all. It's got a lot of heart, and it's got real emotional and physical pain. Let's start with the story behind the idea for the film. Why did you want to make this film? How did you get the idea for it?
I think it started with an observation a long time ago that no one's ever made a serious film about wrestling, and I think that is because most people perceive wrestling as a joke, and because it's fake, and they sort of write it off. In fact, most people, while I was working on this film, were saying, "What exactly are you doing with Mickey Rourke?" And they really didn't get it. But the more I looked into it, the more interesting it got, because you'd meet these guys, and they're 300 pounds, and they're jumping off the top rope down 10 feet into a pile of concrete, and you know, you can't find me anyone who's not going to feel that the next day. So that whole line between what's real and what's fake started to become really interesting.
Now, I also think it's really interesting that your movie The Wrestler focuses on washed up, broken down wrestlers who are in chronic pain. These are they're not people who are in their prime anymore. They play these like little matches and in recreation centers and American Legion halls. Why did you focus it on broken down wrestlers?
Well, it came out of the kind of economic approach of the film. I knew it was going to be a low budget film for several reasons. But and when we first started, to be honest, we were thinking a more traditional route of, you know, a 20-something, 30-year-old movie star doing this. But it became pretty clear that working with the WWE at the beginning might not give the type of creative control I would need.
Oh, man, I bet they'd want a lot of money. I mean, everything is just so marketed and franchised that they own a piece of everything.
But Vince actually, Vince McMahon, saw the film, and he called both me and Mickey and was really, really touched by it. And we were very nervous, wondering what he would think, but he really, really felt the film was special, and having his support meant a lot to us, especially to Mickey.
And he kind of controls the wrestling world.
Pretty much. I mean, definitely everything that most people know about wrestling comes out of what Vince McMahon did, but there's this whole other world of wrestling for people who aren't working, you know, that mainstream, but still want to wrestle. There's the independent circuit, and it's how wrestling used to be before it was all kind of combined into one sort of national league. So after we realized that, I started to think of it first as a period piece, because before the WWE existed, there were all these territories out there, you know, in the 70s and 80s, early 80s. But once again, budget-wise, I didn't think I could do that either. So then I started going to these independent shows, which exist all over the country. And they're actually really interesting because they have a lot of up-and-coming wrestlers, guys who, you know, want to go to the big league. And then they also have, you know, people that will never make it. And then they also have a lot of these legends that were huge back in the day, you know, men and women that would sell out Madison Square Garden and the L.A. Forum night after night after night, who basically are working for $500 a night in front of 200-300 people. And suddenly that became a really kind of intriguing story.
Wrestling is really like the theater of cruelty and suffering. And I think that's really what you capture in the movie. And one of the most amazing scenes is a match between Randy, the Mickey Rourke character, and the Necro Butcher, Keith Dillon Summers, who's a real wrestler who plays himself in the movie.
Yeah.
And yeah. I didn't realize that wrestling – I watched wrestling in the 80s, and I haven't kept up with it, and I didn't realize it had gotten this hardcore where, like, the Butcher uses a staple gun with these, like, big staples and barbed wire, and it's a real bloody affair. Before we talk about it, I want to just play a clip from the movie, and this is, like, backstage, so to speak, before the actual match between Randy the Ram and the Necro Butcher, and they're talking to each other, trying to, you know, plan a little bit what the match will be like. And the Necro Butcher speaks first.
Anything you need me to do, sir, just maybe keep the running to a minimum. Like maybe I can hit the ropes once, take a bump for you, but like no crisscrossing, please.
Yeah, it's hardcore stuff. I mean, will you talk to me about it? What do you want to do tonight?
Well, are you cool with the staples?
Staples?
Staple gun.
What do you mean?
Like, staple gun.
Staple gun.
You never did it before?
No.
That's a silly question. Man, not so bad going in. Yeah. Kind of scary. You know, you got a big metal thing up against you. But well, pulling them out, they're going to leave a couple little holes, a little bit of blood loss there.
Rock and roll.
Thank you, sir. It's an honor. Thank you.
Take it easy with that staple gun.
No problem, sir.
One of the amazing things about this is that here's, like, you know, the Butcher talking about how he's going to use the staple gun and he's going to hurt. And he's calling him sir and you know, anything you need me to do, sir. It's just such an odd mix. Is this a typical pre-match kind of conversation?
You know, I mean, it's definitely pushed a little bit for the audience's sake. Wrestlers do discuss what they're going to do beforehand. We might have spelled it out a little bit more. But that scene was actually not scripted. That was purely improvised. We shot every wrestling scene in the film. We shot in front of live wrestling audiences with real wrestlers. So everyone Mickey Rourke wrestles is a real life wrestler, as you said. And so while we were waiting for our chance to get out there because there was a match going on, I had some time to kill, and I was like, you know, hey Mickey, go over to Necro and just start a conversation. And it kind of evolved into that. And I said, oh, yeah, that part's great. And then we did another take, and that's what you see. It's only 2-3 takes. And what was great about working with these wrestlers is that, you know, they're as much athletes as they are actors. You know, when you're backstage, it's, you know, like being backstage at a theater more than it is being backstage at a sporting event. And so they were very natural in front of the camera and very realistic. And so that was a lot of fun, all the improvisation and stuff that could go on back there.
I'm going to ask you to describe that match between, you know, the Mickey Rourke character and the Necro Butcher. It's the most, I think, brutal, painful match in the movie. So I'd like you to describe what happens and how you shot it.
Well, to begin, you know, Necro Butcher is a real kind of underground cult American hero. He's a real wrestler, and he's always top billing at every wrestling event he goes to. And he basically gets flown around the United States to come to these events, and people go crazy for him. They're very much into his type of wrestling. And it's an interesting form of wrestling. It kind of I have a whole theory about it. You know, wrestling got really bloody in the late 90s because I think it had to do with the simultaneous announcement by the WWE that wrestling was entertainment. And I think once that the whole idea that this was entertainment and not, you know, an athletic contest, the audience knows that and the audience is in on it. What makes it interesting, I think, for certain parts of the audience is the level of violence that these men do to each other. And so when we start to do this film, I knew that would be a really important part because it is a big chunk of the independent wrestling circuit. So basically, Mickey's character, the Ram, goes to one of these hardcore matches, one of his first, and basically these guys bring their own weapons that they buy at a 99-cent store or a hardware store into the ring, and they proceed to, you know, use those different tools on each other. And, you know, this happens in real life all the time. And they even have events where the audience is encouraged to bring their own weapons, and then the wrestlers use those against each other, you know, just to prove to people that there's very little trickery going on.
So in this match, the Necro Butcher actually uses this really big staple gun.
Yeah.
And he staples right up and down Mickey Rourke's back. And then there's like barbed wire that they're using on each other and get caught in, and a plate glass
window
that
not...
smash over the, one smashes over the other's head. I mean, it's really brutal. But then there's this amazing scene afterwards, you know, backstage, so to speak, after the fight, when you see Mickey Rourke's back after all the staples have been pulled out, and it's just so painful to look at it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's sort of what these guys go through. And it's funny, you know, at the premiere a few weeks ago, we invited all these famous legends to come and see the film. And there was a guy, you may remember, Greg the Hammer Valentine. And he told me that he actually wrestled with Dylan the Necro Butcher 2 weeks earlier. So it's, you know, I think it's that they're out there just trying to entertain, trying to hold on to their glory, trying to remain relevant and, you know, at the cost of their health.
So tell me what you learned about the stunt where, you know, the wrestler, in this case, Mickey Rourke, this is one of his specialties in the movie. He climbs on the top rope and positions himself, kind of shows his muscles, and then and then dives onto
head first.
Onto his opponent, who's laying there, in quotes, helplessly on the floor of the ring. Like, what did you learn about how to do that without killing yourself or killing your opponent?
Well, you know, they are, most of the time, if it's done right, you know, the wrestler who's leaping lands, his knees will hit first, so that, you know, there's not direct impact of that force hitting the other guy. Once again, this is, you know, the creed of wrestlers, you know, protecting their opponent. I mean, kind of the rule number one is to take care of your opponent. So, you know, often these guys are taking the hits themselves to put their opponents over, is how they put it. It's a really interesting thing. I mean, it's a lot of history to it, I think. I really wasn't able to track down where wrestling comes from as far as, you know, this type of form of wrestling. Of course, Greco-Roman wrestling is ancient. But I have a feeling it was, you know, they speak this language that's got its own words. It's almost like a carny language. You know, they call the audience the mark. There's terms for keeping all the wrestling secrets secret. They, you know, the performance is the show, and the good guys are baby faces, the bad guys are heels, and it's all about their secret language so that no one knows. So I think it came out of, you know, the strong men fighting each other back in the sideshow days. So it's got a long history, and because of that, they've got their own kind of communication and language, and that was what was interesting is how much of a world it is.
Your interest seems to be beyond the theater of wrestling. I mean, I think you're really interested in the human body and what it can endure and what it means to suffer pain, what the body can take and what it can't take. Yes?
I think that's in there. I don't know how much conscious I am going into it. I know these themes are, you know, I think how people manipulate their bodies to make art is pretty interesting. I see, for me, I think you can take the word wrestling out of this film and change it with any art or any vocation that someone is passionate about. And, you know, the story rings true. It's funny, when I was on the road doing the film in Dallas, I met a preacher who was, I don't know, in his 50s. And he said, you know, from the beginning of the film, he started crying because he just so connected with the Rams story, and how he connected it with was that, you know, he's watching his own congregation shrink as everyone wants to get a younger and younger preacher. And so he had just told his wife recently how he'll be preaching till there's only one person left in the stands. So it's kind of a similar story.
That leads me right into my other favorite scene. Like, one of my favorite scenes is that really violent one that we just talked about. And then there's another scene where it's a Legends of Wrestling signing. And these, like, washed-up wrestlers are there with their videos and their T-shirts to autograph for fans and to sell. They're selling the T-shirts. They're selling the autographs. You know, for a price, you can get a picture taken with them. Yeah. And so they're in this, like, what, is a high school gym or a rec center?
That was a veterans hall, actually.
A veterans hall. So it's just, like, little, you know, little place. And, you know, like, a handful of fans are showing up. And the wrestlers are so over the hill. Like, one of them, I think, has a prosthetic leg, and one of them's in a wheelchair. They're yawning. Yeah. They're sleeping. No one's there for the autograph.
Yeah.
And it's a great scene about what it's like to still be selling the autographs when no one much wants them anymore.
Yeah. Well, that comes directly out of something I witnessed. One of the first research trips I did, me and my co-producer Mark Kamen went to an event out in Jersey, and there were so many legends there, from Captain Lou Albano to Rocky Johnson, who's The Rock's dad, to Jimmy Superfly Snuka. They had a ring set up in the middle, and there was all these legends, and less people came to that than came to what – to the amount of extras I had in that scene. And it was heartbreaking. It's, you know, these guys just trying to make ends meet, trying to live their past glories, and just trying to hold on to the dream. And I just knew we had to do that scene after I witnessed it.
Mickey Rourke got an Academy Award nomination for his performance in the film. It's an incredible performance because he has so much heart and also does a lot of the stunts himself, and I'm sure did a lot of suffering during the making of the movie. How did you choose him? I had read that you were first going to go with Nicolas Cage and then decided to go with Mickey Rourke.
It was actually always Mickey. From the point where we got the idea for him. And the problem was no one in the whole entire world wanted to finance the movie with him. Basically how financing for movies works is you go to the international market, and depending on who the movie star is, you can and what the project is and who the director is, but really the movie star, you basically can get loans off of what people promise to pay for it internationally. But the problem was Mickey was actually pretty much a negative in getting this film made. And I think that's because, you know, where his status as a movie star was, it just had fallen so much. And but he just made so much sense for me. But after about a year and a half of, you know, no after no after no after no, I started to get a little antsy because I didn't think the film was going to happen. And there was a small flirtation with another actor, but ultimately, and that ended up getting picked up, because once you start doing something with a movie star, you know, they don't write about the year and a half of struggling to make a film with Mickey Rourke. They write about, you know, the flirtation with a movie star. That makes the front page.
Well, why did you know Mickey Rourke was going to be right? It turns out you were correct.
I don't know. You know, I was a big fan when I was a kid. I can remember the exact moment of seeing Angel Heart, the theater, and just being blown away by him. And I was a big fan through Barfly and his other work. And I think, like a lot of people, you just wondered what the hell happened to him. And, you know, I think Adrian Lyne told him that if he had died back then, he'd be bigger than James Dean. And it's pretty cruel, but there's something – I mean, that's how huge of a star he was. You know, and on the promotion, you know, talking to – you know, promoting the film, I've gotten the chance to talk to Sean Penn and Benicio del Toro and Brad Pitt, and they're all that, you know, Mickey was the guy, but he just sort of disappeared. And I think when I met Mickey, I thought I knew he had been an athlete, you know, because the boxing story, you know, that he went and became a boxer was very well known. So I thought that might help. And also, just sitting with him, you look into his eyes and, you know, his body is just all this armor and he wears all these outfits. And it's all about keeping people away from looking in his eyes. Because the second you look into his eyes, it's just there's so much there that it was really exciting as a filmmaker. And if I have any great accomplishment on this film, it's the fact that Mickey Rourke never wore a pair of sunglasses in the entire film. Which you show me another film where that happened, and I don't think it exists.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Dave Davies in for Terry Gross. We're listening to Terry's conversation with Darren Aronofsky, the director of the film The Wrestler, which comes out on DVD next week. Mickey Rourke was nominated for an Oscar for his performance as Randy the Ram Robinson, a washed-up wrestling star now reduced to matches in high school gyms and recreation centers. His personal life is as broken as his body. He lives alone in a trailer park, and his only friend is an over-the-hill stripper who feels she has to treat him like a customer. Here's a clip from the film. In this scene, he's trying to reconcile with his estranged adult daughter. He's taken her to the boardwalk where they used to go when she was a child.
I just want to tell you, I'm the one who is supposed to take care of everything. I'm the one who is supposed to make everything okay for everybody. But it just didn't work out like that. And I left. I left you. You never did anything wrong. I used to try to forget about you. I used to try to pretend that you didn't exist. But I can't. You're my girl. You're my little girl. And now I'm an old broken down piece of meat. And I'm alone. And I deserve to be all alone. I just don't want you to hate me.
Mickey Rourke in a scene from The Wrestler. Let's get back to Terry's interview with the film's director, Darren Aronofsky.
Mickey Rourke has said that you were very hard on him while he was making the movie. What did he mean?
Well, you know, Mickey's blessed with more talent in his pinky than most of us have in a lifetime. And so it's very easy for him to coast through his work. And I think that's what we've seen for the last 10, 15 years. And to be honest, I'd say Mickey worked really hard on this film, but he didn't give me everything. I mean, he says he gave me everything, and he probably did, but there's even more in there. And that's how talented he is. He is so gifted. But because he is, he's just a little bit afraid of it. And also, you know, it's just hasn't been put to the test. And so if anything, my biggest job was just to push, pull, encourage, inspire, challenge, you know, for him to really, really dig deep.
Now, he has the kind of muscle in this film that you usually need steroids to get. And his character does shoot steroids in order to get his muscles. So what did he do to get the muscle legally?
He worked really hard. I mean, since it took a year and a half to raise the money, and he knew about it for that long, it was ultimately about 2 years he had to start thinking about it. He hired this really hardcore trainer, this former Israeli commando who was a former cage fighter, and the guy just took no BS, and he lifted twice a day, drank about 7,000 calories a day, and was always walking around with one of those shakes. And the thing is, Mickey's dad, his real dad, was actually a Mr. New York bodybuilder. And so I think he's always been kind of a gym rat. So he's in that culture.
Marissa Tomei, I read that you went to high school with her?
We went to the same high school. I was friends with her brother. She was already kind of a legend when I was there, because she was on TV and stuff.
I see.
Was pretty famous.
Uh-huh.
But then, you know, as I made a film or two in the business, I got to meet her, and we've just been very friendly for years.
She, in the movie, plays a pole dancer and lap dancer who works at a strip club. that Mickey Rourke's character goes to, and he really loves her, and she feels something for him, but he's a customer. So
right.
It's nothing that she can really express. And like him, she's kind of washed up. She's still working, but uh-huh. The customers consider her old. There's some terrific scenes on the pole, because there's times when she's really getting into the pole dancing, and other times when it's so clear that she's doing it quite mechanically. You do this yeah. motion, you do that motion, you look and see if anybody's interested. And I guess I'm wondering what kind of advice you gave her about when she was doing it just mechanically and disengaged to make it look as disengaged as she was feeling.
I think she, you know, Marissa took a role that could have been done very one-dimensionally, and she added a lot of dimension to it. Because for me, her character was always kind of as much a love interest as a mentor for Mickey's character, and that she was going through the same thing, this line between what's real and what's fake. There was the, the realness of her real life outside of the club, and then this fantasy life of the club, and it kind of connected very well with the Ram, Mickey Rourke's characters, the wrestler's struggle of what's real and fake. And the wrestler kind of has confused, what's real, his real life versus his life in the ring, while she's kind of set up these real boundaries to separate and to keep herself healthy. And she's really trying to get more into her real life and sort of leave her fantasy life behind. So all of her scenes with Mickey are about that line, and she just added this, real complexity to it, where she kind of floated between being engaged to being, completely outside of it and above it. For me, she was almost like I call it like a drunken tightrope walker. You know, she's on that tightrope, that line, and yet, you know, what makes her performance dynamic and exciting is you just don't know which way she's going to fall.
There's so many similarities you make between the wrestler and the stripper. They both have stage names. They both have to do their hair, put on makeup. The Ram, Mickey Rourke, has to shave his armpits. And, they both have choreography.
Yeah.
And they both have a different personality in the ring than or in the club yeah. than outside of it. Did you intentionally want to make sure that there was a scene where Mickey Rourke was shaving his armpits just to show how cosmetic you have to be and the similarities between, what a stripper would go through or what a woman would go through and what the wrestlers go through?
You're actually the first to point out that connection. I think in the script it was that he had to shave his chest, and Mickey was against that, shaving his chest, because he was like, there's certain secrets, blah, blah, blah. And I said, you know what? Then shave your underarms. And he couldn't deny it, because he realized in many ways it was more revealing and embarrassing, yet, it happens. So he went for it. But that was kind of the whole spirit of the whole film, is me and Mickey kind of there was just a lot of improvisation always, and Mickey bringing his own expertise and his own history to it, and then sort of happy accidents happen where the connection between their underarm hair is made for someone like you.
No, another great scene I have to ask you about is in the supermarket. There's a period in which the Ram, the Mickey Rourke character, is unable to work as a wrestler,
yeah.
and so he's working at behind the deli counter at an Acme supermarket.
In Bayonne, New Jersey.
Yeah, I was wondering where it was, because it looks like it's a real supermarket.
Oh, yeah.
And I read that some of the customers were real, too.
Yeah, well, the whole thing was, we didn't have enough money to close down the supermarket or even close down the meat deli counter where we were shooting. So people were coming up and asking for, and all those other workers behind, with Mickey were the actual employees, So I was like, hey, Mickey, just go serve these people. So he was game. That was once again, a lot of improvisation and Mickey bringing his own spirit to the screen.
So what do the customers think? They must have seen the camera. Did they know that they were shooting a movie? Did they know that was Mickey Rourke behind the counter serving them?
I think that's the advantage of having someone like Mickey Rourke at that point in his career, is that most people with his hair up in a hair bun aren't going to recognize him. And even if they do, they're not going to be screaming through the aisles, you know, for an autograph. So people were very – they were kind of natural, you know, and – with so much reality TV going on and so much I think people are really comfortable now and they just don't care. So, you know, they were just, you know, that woman who was asking for the fried chicken was just a woman who came up and, you know, she said, give me two big breasts. And Mickey made up the line, that's what I'm looking for, two big breasts with a brain, you know. And it was just – it was perfect, but it just happened.
Now, I have to say, your films seem so – about pain, pain and drugs. In Pi, the main character who's really into math and how math can like describe the world and explain patterns in the world, and but he has these terrible migraines, which is how the movie starts. In your film Requiem for a Dream, which is an adaptation of a Hubert Selby novel, and he also wrote Last Exit to Brooklyn. You know, there's like drug addicts. The mother is addicted to amphetamines. And the Jared Leto character, who's a heroin addict, I mean, he gets this horrible infection in his arm from shooting up with dirty needles. And toward the end, he injects himself right into the heart of the infection and ends up having his arm amputated at the end. I mean, like, tell me that I'm wrong, but it seems to me between that and the wrestler that you are interested in pain.
Have you not seen The Fountain?
I have not seen The Fountain. Is there more pain in it?
No, you should see it. It's my romantic film.
Oh, I see. Okay.
Yeah. But you should go see that. I mean, there's kind of drugs and there's different type of pain. There's broken heart pain in that one.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. The connection between the three films, it's so, you know, people see different things, you know, between, you know, it's funny. Someone was talking about how all of my characters fall at the end, you know, Requiem for a Dream, Jared Leto falls, and the wrestler, he falls, and in The Fountain, Hugh Jackman's character falls. So I don't know, people see different things, and, you know, I'm just happy that people are making connections between the films, that it's a sense that I'm not losing myself as I get older through this life.
Oh, tell me you're not interested in pain. I just would find that impossible to have made these movies and not thought about that.
You're talking about physical and emotional pain, or you're talking about...
I'm talking about both, but I think there's a real strong feeling about physical pain throughout your films, with the exception of The Fountain, which I haven't seen.
Wow. I guess, yeah. I couldn't tell you that it's something that I'm focused on. And when I approach this, that's like the thing that's pulling me to the subject matter. Mm-hmm. It must just somehow come out in the work. People talk about that there's obsession in there and the struggle between people choosing their real life versus their art. So there's lots of different themes, I think, but I wouldn't say I approach a project thinking about the emotional, physical pain of the characters before going in. I do think that the emotional end of it is very, very important, because you want people to connect with these characters and feel for these characters and be touched by them, hopefully.
Your cinematographer is best known for documentary films, for Taxi to the Dark Side and Enron, The Smartest Guys in the Room. Why did you want to use a documentary cinematographer?
Well, Maurice Alberte, she was not only had she done great documentaries, to add to that list, she also did Crumb.
Great film. Yeah.
Yeah, great film. She also, before that, did a lot of narrative films. She worked with Todd Haynes on Velvet Goldmine, and she shot Happiness for Todd Solondz.
Oh, wow.
So she had this independent, narrative experience as well as documentary experience. I always knew I wanted to bring a verite style to this film. It's how I was trained when I was in film school, and it's something I haven't done in a really long time. And I almost did a documentary instead of this movie. I just sort of wanted to get back to grounding myself in reality. And so that was the approach. I wanted that immediate energy approach of the film, and I just wanted that feeling when we went into those wrestling worlds, when we went into the wrestling ring itself, that we were really there. And she was great because she just was game to shoot anything, anywhere, anytime.
My guest is Darren Aronofsky. He directed the new film, The Wrestler. You grew up in Brooklyn. I think both of your parents were high school teachers?
No, my mom taught public school 206 on Neck Road.
Oh, wow. I know Neck Road.
And my dad taught at Bushwick High School, which I think at the time, New York Post said it was the worst high school in North America.
This was a dangerous school.
Yeah, it was pretty dangerous back in the day. Now it's all filled with, you know, hipsters, but back in the day it wasn't too good.
And your father could handle it?
He's a big guy. Unfortunately, I didn't inherit his shoulders. I got his height, but not his shoulders.
No, it sounds like you had a very middle class upbringing. But, you know, filmically, like, you're interested in Hubert Selby, who writes novels about people who are, like, down on their luck and addicted and desperate. You know, The Wrestler also about, you know, someone who's broke and, you know, physically, emotionally, and financially.
Well, if you saw The Fountain, it's about a middle-class scientist. Middle-upper class. Brooklyn's one of those weird places where, you know, you could be in a sort of middle-class neighborhood, which is, I guess, where I grew up was. But, you know, the guy, I guess, the three kids that were my age that grew up, you know, two of them are in jail and one of them's dead. You know, half my friends became stockbrokers and half of them became drug dealers. And then, you know, that was my neighborhood. You know, you go 5 minutes outside of the neighborhood and it's a whole different world. So it's not you don't really live in a bubble when you're in Brooklyn. You're kind of – even if your section is – one thing, it's kind of a big mix that you can't escape. I mean, when I was in college, I drove a car service type of thing in the neighborhood, and I couldn't believe it. But literally, a 5 minute walk from my house where I grew up was one of the big, you know, crack supply, you know, spots, and I would be driving people to get their stuff. It's just it's a very strange place, Brooklyn, in that way.
Now, at the Golden Globes, when Mickey Rourke won, and he was at the mic, I forget exactly what he said about you that was a kind of loving, sarcastic thing, and in return you gave him the finger, and the camera was on
you. That's a loving, sarcastic return for a kid from Brooklyn.
No, exactly, right, exactly. But the camera was on you, and I'm sure, tell me what the producers of the Golden Globes or the network that carry it had to say about it. Anything?
I haven't heard anything. I mean, I had a big smile on my face, and I mean, for me and Mickey, we're old friends, and that actually means I love you between us. So it was done with a lot of love.
Well, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you for having me.
Director Darren Aronofsky speaking with Terry Gross. Aronofsky's film The Wrestler is out next week on DVD. Film critic David Edelstein has a review of State of Play, a new political thriller adapted from a 2003 BBC miniseries. The setting has been changed to Washington and stars Russell Crowe and Ben Affleck.
The American version of State of Play feels creaky and nostalgic. It's as if the filmmakers are pining for the days when journalists were all that stood between us and an alliance of the military-industrial complex and crypto-fascist politicians. They'd like to bring back the atmosphere of Watergate and All the President's Men. The reporters, played by Russell Crowe and Rachel McAdams, are photographed through windows or from high above or behind cars in underground garages as if someone's always watching, while in the background loom icons like the Washington Monument to remind us how American ideals have been perverted. For a while, it's gripping stuff, and Crowe's edginess gives the convoluted plot a charge. The problem is, the filmmakers aren't remaking All the President's Men. They're remaking a six-hour British miniseries with a different thrust. Both versions of State of Play center on university pals who've gone different ways. Cal McCaffrey is a scruffy journalist, and Stephen Collins, a slick, ambitious politician. An aide to Collins, his mistress, it turns out, is murdered. It's a PR disaster, and Cal is torn. He wants to help his friend clear his name, and he wants to get the story. The miniseries was an ensemble piece and a portrait of two machines, one investigative, one legislative. It was also a paranoid conspiracy thriller that opened with a murder. But you sensed that in the end, it wouldn't come down to a chase or gun battle, that the answers would be in the characters' faces, in secrets even close friends couldn't detect. The new script by Matthew Michael Carnahan, Tony Gilroy, and Billy Ray makes the reporter more of a lone wolf. Gone is the give and take among multiple characters that gave the newspaper scene's texture. It's also a stew of topical headlines. The unchecked power of a Blackwater-like security firm, the financial straits of daily newspapers, the rise of gossipy bloggers. The allusions add punch, and the Watergate tropes ratchet up suspense, but they prime you for a more conventional thriller. Everything added turns out to be beside the point. The point is blunted anyway, because the new state of play is a study in stars' non-combustion. Crowe and Ben Affleck as Collins don't fit together. They don't inhabit the same existential space. Crowe is a transformer. His actor's DNA changes in every role, and you always feel his mind racing. Whereas Affleck is slack-jawed, dopey, not quite broken in. He's temperamentally suited to the part. His opaque, Al Gore-ish affect is the reason we infer his character went into politics. But his wheels turn too slowly to keep up. Crowe is doing all the acting.
Gotta get you, Stephen. One way or another, they got 40 billion good reasons to want you out of the way. You gotta go on the record. Swing the spotlight back on them. You gotta protect yourself, man.
You go out there and find me evidence linking Sonia's death to Point Core. I will go on the record. I will shout this thing from the rooftops.
I can do that.
All right. I gotta get back. I'll be in touch.
Stephen.
Yeah.
Just watch your back.
You too.
The music under that scene is one way director Kevin MacDonald gives the illusion of momentum. And until the climax, the movie does fly along, with excellent actors bobbing in and out. It was a neat idea to make McAdams' character a cheeky blogger and an insult to Cal's journalistic scruples, although after a good confrontational start, she settles into the role of sidekick. Robin Wright Penn brings amazing depth of emotion to Collins' wife. Forced to stand by her man, she evokes the poor spouse of Elliot Spitzer after his prostitution scandal. As the editor of the Washington Globe, Helen Mirren is perfection. Watch how abruptly she shifts from solicitous to chummy to imperious, anything to get what she needs from her reporters and keep her endangered newspaper afloat. But the climax to which the movie builds is, in this context, a non-event, feeble, spurious, and so 1974. State of Play is like a time bomb that's never dismantled, but never explodes.
David Edelstein is film critic for New York Magazine. You can download podcasts of our show at freshair.npr.org. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. The San Francisco music community lost one of their veterans this week. Tenor saxophonist Ron Stallings died on Monday after a long battle with cancer. He was 62. Stallings was part of the Bay Area rock, jazz, and Afro-Cuban music scene, having performed with Jerry Garcia, Mike Bloomfield, Jesse Colin Young, McCoy Tyner, Chucho Valdez, and John Santos. He toured for 14 years as a member of Huey Lewis and the News. We'll close today's show with a 1969 recording by the blues rock band Mother Earth, which usually featured Tracy Nelson on vocals. But on this track, Ron Stallings left the horn section and stepped up to the mic to do the singing. I'm Dave Davies, and this is Fresh Air.
I want a good man, no good, no good, I must confess. But my baby's so true and so sweet, she really, really done her best. Now I bet some of you fellas say, I wish I had a girl like that. Well, here's good news for some lucky guy, cause she's leaving and she ain't coming back. Oh, I'm gonna beg the conductor to please stop that train. Yes, I'm gonna beg the conductor to please stop that train. Love, you better play it straight, cause that's something hard to find. That's why I'm trying to reach the train depot, so I can try to repossess mine. Now to all you playboys, here's a warning, you better fall in line and try to be true. Cause one day, my friend, the table's gonna turn, and here's what you'll have to do. You'll have to beg the conductor to please stop that train. Yes, you'll have to beg the conductor to please stop.